Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Friday, the 11th of May. It's very nice to have you on the program, have you with us listening to the program. You're not on it. You haven't gotten that far. But maybe it could be someday.
I think
girl
it,
can there's
dream.
Always hope.
Yes, that's right. dream. We'll introduce you to the people who have made it in just a moment. It's 13 minutes past 9 o'clock, and we do welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Alan Chartok is with us. Good morning, Alan.
I'm delighted to be here. I barely made the cut, but I'm here.
Hardly. Judith Enck is here. She is a former regional administrator for the Environmental Protection Agency, a regular on our program on Fridays, and we are thrilled to have her back. Good morning.
Good morning, Joe.
Very nice to have you here. David Soares is the district attorney from the county of Albany, and we are thrilled to have him here this morning. Good morning, sir.
Hello. How is everybody doing today?
We're all right. It seems low energy right now, but I think that'll change.
What no, I have a lot of energy. I'm inspired today.
Inspired.
I am fired up.
Joe Bonilla is here as well. He's a communications consultant and a regular on our program, and we're thrilled to have you. Thank you very much.
As always, good morning.
Aaron Pasitti, who normally would be with us, is away today from Siena College, so he'll be back with us next week. All right. Well, we have a lot to talk about, and we'll get right to it. Kirstjen Nielsen is the chief of Homeland Security. And apparently the president just went off on her last night, just berated her in front of the entire cabinet for what he said was her failure to adequately secure the nation's borders. A lot of people talked about this episode, current officials, former officials, and said that it was, you know, not great. So Nielsen is a protege of John Kelly, who is the White House chief of staff, of course. And so what did she do? Well, she went back and she penned her resignation letter. And then I think we're in the I'm counting to 10 stage, right? Where you count to 10 before you actually, oh, is this a good idea? Let's see what happens. But obviously the word got out that she did indeed have a letter ready to go if that was the case. She's been the head of the Department of Homeland Security in charge of 20,000 employees who work for Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Mr. Trump's anger towards her, who was sitting several seats to his left at the meeting, was part of a lengthy tirade in which the president railed at his cabinet about what he said was its lack of progress towards sealing the country's borders against illegal immigrants. Well, what should we make of this, Alan?
Well, there's a couple of things here. First of all, we now know that a lot of the leaks that come out of the White House, it's extraordinary that you have leaks. You have leaks about McCain, what some person said about McCain dying and all of that, that a lot of the leaks that come out of the White House have, in fact, come from Trump himself. So one wonders whether this is not a play to the base once again. In other words, I'm still on your side. I want to keep those nasty immigrants out of the country, and I'm doing it that way, and you're not doing your job. And that's a signal that he's holding everybody accountable for making it better because he can't prove it otherwise. I suspect that may be part of it.
Isn't this what he used to do on a show?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
he would berate Gary Busey.
And yes.
And he's doing it.
It all seems so benign then, though.
Well, you know, but you make a very good point there, David, and that is that we know that Trump has emulated a lot of his successes from the television in terms of he's trying to emulate anyway his successes from the television in his presidency. And you know, it's funny that we say it when we say it, but it is in fact pathetic and true.
Yeah, it's, you know, the other night when the hostages were returned, you know, at 1 or 2 a.m. in the morning, yeah, having the entire airport, the landing pads, the lighting, the camera, all of that choreography so that he can have that moment. And then, you know, as if we didn't know that that's what he was doing, that he was crafting this. He then reminds the networks that this has to be their strongest ratings that they've ever received at 3 a.m.
At 3 a.m. in the
morning.
Right. He's probably right, other than a royal wedding, but
well,
sure.
It's been brought up that perhaps, Joe, what's the Paris Hilton getting out of jail outdid it. But I, of course, don't even remember that she went to jail, so what can I say?
Oh, how can you forget that?
I forgot.
Such a law-abiding citizen.
Yes.
I think Alan raises an interesting point. Trump himself may have leaked the story that he berated the Homeland Security Director. I do think, with the giant exception of Scott Pruitt, there's probably a computer program in Washington, D.C. for resignation letters.
Jeff Sessions had his
drafted.
That he just handed to her.
Right. Rex Tillerson. I mean,
the holder.
I think if you're a cabinet member, that letter kind of writes itself, with the exception, of course, of
Although,
Scott Pruitt.
In this administration, they may just buy them on the Internet.
True.
Well, they pay a whole lot more, too, than you and I would.
That's right. It's just like their term papers.
Yeah. It could just be one sentence, effective immediately. I'm out of here. Good luck with the sinking Titanic. But I think what's interesting is the substance here of, you know, not only Trump saying he wants to close the borders, but Ms. Nielsen is started to try to repair her public image. And she's articulated that her fight with Trump is she's not going along with the policy of separating families, and which is really an abhorrent policy. And I think, like so many people who work for Trump, you want to repair your public image. And that's going to be, you know, the hill that she dies on is I try to keep families together. He wouldn't let me. That's why I'm in the doghouse.
I would like to read one sentence from this article from the New York Times. During the meeting, Mr. Trump yelled about the United States' porous border and said more needed to be done to fix it. When members of his cabinet pointed out that the country relies on day laborers who cross the border each day, Mr. Trump said that was fine, but continued to explain and yell.
Well, I mean, people should also be reminded of the fact that, you know, we've got the midterms that are upon us.
Very
and
close, sure.
He is going to be scheduling more and more of these rallies, mm-hmm. like the one that he had in Indiana. And so the idea that he can leak something that he will then be able to talk about and continue along with those themes of his campaign that were successful for him in some of those, you know, challenging communities right now, I think we'll see more and more of this. And you know, the only question, not question so much as objection is the term leaks. He showers us. That Washington showers us with information, not leaks.
Eek. Gross. So let me ask this question, because let me ask the question that we always ask when we talk about somebody who perhaps is leaving or has already left the administration, which is, okay, well, here's a person who seems to be standing up to the president, who seems to be bringing important issues to the forefront and saying, okay, well, let's just take a pause and look at where we are now. So if she does indeed tender her resignation, well, then what do we get? What's the next step?
Well, usually it's the usual suspects of the next level of terribleness, really, when you think about it. We've gotten in this situation. The first cabinet appointee is always somebody of the traditional Republican establishment. And then we get really into the weeds where we've seen Rex Tillerson being replaced by Mike Pompeo and other things like that. So that's where we're going with this. So if she were to leave, we're only going to be found with another right-winger in the situation.
Maybe we'll get Stephen Miller.
Right.
That is probably his dream. And remember, she is the second person to hold the position, replacing Kelly. And, the number of cabinet members and White House staff who have left in a year and a half is just extraordinary. It's, you know, I don't recall the most recent numbers, but you compare it to not only the Obama administration, but Bush and Clinton, and it's easily three times the number of people who have fled. So you have people who come in, or they're not just the B team. I mean, they're the M team. They're the Z team.
Right. There's no letter to describe.
But unfortunately, they come with credentials of extremism. And so that's what, you know, I think if you're sitting back and you're watching this and this is strictly entertainment, you know, it's kind of funny. But these are people that have policy-making authority. And I think if we're looking at what's recently transpired with the Iran nuclear deal and John Bolton having, you know, taking front and center in the position that he's in, it's pretty frightening because those decisions have consequences. And unfortunately, it's not going to be these people that are suiting up and preparing for battle. They're going to have bones and foot bones in their feet and other chips and other shavings that will prevent them from actually having to do the work, just like the president in his dodging of his military obligations. But, you know, the problem with President Trump's bench is that the further down the bench that you get, the more vile the characters seem to be.
Right. Well, remember, right after the election, Steve Bannon appeared at CPAC and said the goal of these cabinet members is to deconstruct their agencies. So Betsy DeVoe doesn't believe in public education. Scott Pruitt is in the pocket of polluters. Rick Perry, you know,
energy.
Got very good on Dancing with the Stars, not so good as the energy secretary. I mean, you go down the list. But what's interesting in Trump's aggressive attack on immigrants and dealing with the so-called poorest border, except for day laborers who want to come in and work for $5 an hour to do backbreaking work that no one else will do, he needs a functioning agency. They're well resourced. But you know, his notion of destroying agencies doesn't work for him here.
This has been an obsession with him for the last couple of weeks, and that things were not going well as far as what he wanted to achieve when it came to immigration. He said at the NRA meeting last week in Dallas, "We don't have laws. We have laws that were written by people that truly could not love our country." I believe that would have been our founding fathers. Yes, is that who he was referring to?
What a, you know, the other thing that I might posit here is when you think about this administration, you think about this person's philosophical approach to foreign policy. You know, our immigration problem stems largely in part of the financial distress that people are experiencing south of the border. And of course, as the weather is getting warmer and there is the need for day laborers, you're going to see the numbers increase in terms of people who are coming, you know, over the border. And here you have a president that continues to use foreign aid as a weapon. And so I don't understand how exactly he's going to make Mexico pay for the wall. He's not contributing at all or you know, with in terms of foreign policy, in terms of aid to the well-being of that nation. And so how are you going to continue? How are you going to cure, you know, these issues? I mean, the only option that you have is building a wall. And we know that that's never going to happen here.
Mm-hmm. Well, there is a point here, and that is, do we really believe he gives a damn about what happens as much as what he says about what should happen? I mean, he obviously has to follow up and say, okay, we want to make sure that those people don't come in and that we get a wall and the rest of it. But his articulation, which leads to a, quote, potential third term, that is really important here. Not so much what gets done.
So when you think of that and not so much what gets done, I mean, it is obviously he's looking toward this focus on immigration and wanting to get something done. But you wonder whether because we have the laws that we have and because the things are in place and because courts are acting, that if he will ever truly get what he wants for that, because a lot of the things that he talked about on the campaign, well, you just can't realize those. Maybe you can. I don't know.
Well, we'll
it doesn't
see what,
seem
we'll,
to see what the court
says. He's very upset about losing the Muslim travel ban, and that is now with the Supreme Court. So, right, David?
That's right. And, you know, I think the other thing that, and I try to remind listeners as often as I can, is the feverish pace that the administration is currently stacking, you know, the courts. And I know people tend to think of the Supreme Court as being the final say. I would just like to remind people that the vast majority of law that's made in this country isn't made at the Supreme Court. It's really made at the appellate level courts that are being stacked right now by Mr. Trump. And you're right. I mean, in order for a lot of these promises that he made on the campaign trail, in order for that to come true, Democrats would have to lie down entirely in the Congress, but our judiciary would have to stop functioning as well. And so, you know, to the extent that some of the vision that he's projected onto the population would come true, I have doubts about that, but that's never been my concern. My concern is the loss of our influence, the destruction, the path of destruction that he's laid, not only in this country, amongst the people who live in this country, you know, the cultural wars, but also what he is doing overseas to destroy our reputation. And so that's what worries me more than, you know, his rants on the political trail.
Well, that's the problem, is that every single day of this administration has a generational impact upon the world, upon the country. And certainly that's really the larger issue at play. It's optics versus operations.
Mm-hmm. And someone did mention Rick Perry a little earlier, and it's interesting that you mentioned Rick Perry at the Energy Department, because I think if this indication of this, the argument that he had, the subsequent leak, and everything that we've been hearing about John Kelly and John Kelly's silence and the how upset Donald Trump is, I would certainly look for a departure, you know. Could be a termination for John Kelly and possibly a replacement with Rick Perry,
mm-hmm.
Because there's no one lining up to take these jobs. But what he's managed to do is take people from certain positions and move them, you know, elsewhere within his administration, like a Pompeo. So that's something certainly to look for.
Rearranging the deck chairs of the Titanic.
Right.
Well, I thought something that popped yesterday was interesting, where John Kelly was interviewed on NPR.
Right.
Full stop, John Kelly on NPR. And he said that the president is embarrassed by these investigations when he meets with heads of state. I think that will come back to haunt John Kelly, because there's no way President Trump wants his chief of staff saying that he's embarrassed because it looks like weakness. And weakness is not what Trump wants to present to the world.
Oh, I don't know, Judith. To be honest, I think that the president, is so paranoid about the investigations and so maybe appropriately paranoid.
Yeah.
That they want it stopped. And this is a narrative which fits, which is, you are embarrassing us before our neighbors and the people we have to deal with, and you should stop it. Sounds right to me.
Well, that's a very interesting perspective. I hadn't thought of that. In order to get more, you know, Republicans, as I think the latest polls have indicated that there's been an erosion there in Republican confidence in the investigation. And so to try to normalize the calling for this investigation to stop, that's certainly injecting a foreign policy swirl there, is something I could see this administration doing. So,
well, make no mistake about it, David. You are so right. And the possibility here, of course, is that they're all looking at impeachment. And if you're looking at the potential for impeachment, and I think it's very good, depending on what happens in the 2018 elections here, then anything goes. And why would anybody be surprised that they're trying to figure out any way to put a stop to it? And the Kelly narrative is exactly right. You know, you're embarrassing us. How many times have kids been told, don't embarrass us in front of our neighbors?
But Mueller doesn't care, and I think congressional Democrats don't care. I mean, we are so beyond embarrassment with this president.
Well, let me go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
No, I don't agree with you. I think this guy is scared to death. He's going to get impeached, that this investigation is going to come down on his head, Judith, that I think anything goes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. We're going to take a very short break. When we come back, we'll continue. And we welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Judith Eng, David Soares and Joe Bonilla. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. So do we have a sense of what, I guess, with the when it comes to Homeland Security, we'll see. I saw Jake Tapper be interviewed the other day, and he said that, or I guess yesterday, and he was he's got a new book out, but he was talking about how if CNN reports that, you know, they're getting ready to fire Tillerson, that the cycle now is that the president will
deny.
Well, right? And will deliberately hold up
right.
the firing so that they don't come out being right.
Right.
So if the whole narrative goes that he leaked the story, and then the press reports it, and then you call it fake news, and then you wait a couple weeks, and then you accept a resignation, yeah. or they're fired.
I think it's a 2-week cycle usually.
10 days.
It's so transparent, though. I mean, I didn't need Jake Tapper to tell me that.
Right. It's like H.R. McMaster.
There's been enough firings in this administration for you to, you know, to see the rhythm. Yeah. You know.
Except Pruitt. he hangs on. There's 11 federal investigations going on with Pruitt, and Trump is standing by him.
I've been saying from day one that we needed a Deadpool here, and to put these folks in their names, I'm saying Pruitt by August.
You think by August?
I think by August.
I don't know about that.
I have no credibility.
I feel Pruitt is Trump's spirit animal.
So I thought Pruitt out that. By Earth Day, but I called that wrong.
Do you think they can go into? Do you think they can go into the midterms, and the aggressive campaigning in the midterms with one of the biggest swamp creatures, you know, in Washington, hanging over their head?
They can.
Yeah, they can. They will.
They can.
They will.
I mean, are you talking about the president or Pruitt?
Is there no decency, man?
I have to quote my dear friend Judith Eng, who said on April 20th on this very program, we should not be having a death pool, as you call it, on when he resigns, but when he is indicted.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, there you go.
I really believe with Pruitt, it's not a question of resignation or being fired. It's a question of when he will be indicted. He has very serious legal exposure. And now there are press reports that he has set up a legal defense fund. And are we going to have fossil fuel companies, you know, contributing to that? Talk about porous borders.
Right,
the
right.
rules on who can contribute to legal defense funds is pretty porous. I mean, my information from, you know, the three people I know in Washington these days is that Pruitt's on the way out. He desperately needs a legal defense fund, and it'll be easy. And the fossil fuel lobbyists have said to him, don't worry, we're going to take care of your legal bills.
I would have certainly subscribed to that had Cohen and AT&T not come about as of this week. I think you're going to see much more hesitancy on the part of corporations or even lobbyists in the way that they provide resources to some of these characters, because it's going to be a field day in terms of transparency on many of those issues. And so I absolutely agree with you. He's going to find money. There are going to be people putting money into his defense fund. I just don't know whether those corporations will be as keenly desirous of doing that, given what's happened with Cohen and AT&T.
Well, I agree, but there are a lot of oil and gas companies in Oklahoma, and then we'll see donations from the children and household pets of fossil fuel lobbyists.
Yeah. Isn't Oklahoma one of the earthquake capitals of
yes,
the world?
Yes, due to hydrofracking, because when you inject the frack fluid underground, there's just been an unprecedented amount of earthquakes, and it's not because of the pulling out the gas. It's the frack fluid going in. It's a huge issue that is underreported. You know, people's homes are damaged, like major earthquakes. Mm-hmm. You know, the radical group USGS has been documenting all of this.
Does it ever occur to any of you that there might be a psychological component to Trump? I mean, we know there's a psychological component to him, but that he, in fact, may enjoy it when somebody else gets into trouble and it ain't him?
Of course.
Schadenfreude, sure.
Yeah, you know, I think you're absolutely right, and he certainly doesn't subscribe to the buck stops here, you know, philosophy, so he doesn't see Pruitt's problems as his own.
Well, remember last week there was a report that Pruitt's press shop at EPA was pitching negative stories about Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke, of which there are many, to divert attention away from
deal.
Pruitt. And then the White House had to get involved and say, cut it out, EPA press people. We know what you're up to.
But Trump has that move, too, where he says, when the firing happens or the sudden resignation, he's a great guy, fantastic,
good
really
man.
Great,
best,
great, very
right.
good man.
He's always a good man. Yeah.
He's a good, right. He's always a good man. And then pause 3 seconds. Although I didn't know him very well, he really didn't do much. He was only came to one meeting. He didn't have much to do with me.
Coffee boy.
Right. That's right. He had an office over there somewhere. Right. We didn't know what he was up to.
Didn't really know Paul Manafort. He wasn't at a high
didn't
level of the campaign.
Yeah.
The revisionist history is like, you know what, Donald? We watched that season, too.
Right.
but
the issue, though, is who replaces Scott Pruitt, as we've been talking about, is only going to be somebody far, far worse.
Yeah, Andy Wheeler was just appointed as the number two. Until recently, he was a lobbyist for coal companies and nuclear power plants. He is an old Washington hand, so he's going to be Scott Pruitt without the, you know, first-class travel and trips to Italy and Morocco because he's more politically savvy. But I think Wheeler actually will do more damage than Pruitt.
Okay. In terms of timing, however, where we are right now, we're in May, and we have a few months before these campaigns really start kicking off, right? Isn't the wise move right now to distance yourself from Pruitt?
Sure.
Ideally, but at this juncture, I mean, we already have primaries happening right now. So,
and remember, he gave a major speech last night as we sit here, indicating that he believes, unlike, you know, the last comment, he believes we're in the middle of the campaign right now.
Right.
Oh, sure.
Right.
But I know this is going to sound like a flip statement, but I mean, how many people can you distance yourself from? I mean,
including family members,
apparently
your wife, your kids.
Apparently, everybody.
Yeah, including yourself.
We got a letter from Julie who says, "I was dismayed by Joe's comments this morning during his lead-in that none of those listening could be on the panel, and that perhaps they did not make the cut." Like those participants on today's show was insulting to me and perhaps others in your listening audience. Julie, that was what we call a joke because I...
No, it was a joke and I appreciated it.
I laughed.
Well, yeah. The point was I misspoke and I said we want to have you be... thank you for joining us for the show. And I said joining us on the show. And I said, oh, you're not on the show. You're just joining us, and that was the little joke.
But if it was misinterpreted, Julie, we apologize.
We apologize.
The entire panel.
Profusely.
And she's saying that I was being elitist by saying that they don't have the credentials that you all have to
get
in.
No. Oh, no. Julie, let me just do something that the President of the United States has never done and probably will never do. Julie, I'm sorry. That was an apology.
Yeah, I am sorry. I didn't mean it to be taken that way. All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue, and maybe we'll get more letters, and we'll talk about other stuff. We welcome your thoughts. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Alan Chartok, Judith Eng, David Soares, and Joe Bonilla making up the panel this morning, and whoever else wants to. Come on over.
There you go.
We have an extra chair. All right. Jim writes to us regarding North Korea. He says, I'm concerned that even a flawed claim success in the North Korean negotiations will make Trump more difficult to impeach, indict, remove from office, and expedite the march toward authoritarianism in the U.S. Trump and the Trumpets, 90% of Republicans, are the greatest threat America faces. I will say, add to this letter, that I thought it was interesting on some of the cable news shows last night that they were talking about this being the president's best week. And I get it, and yet because of the of the release, and then of the three hostages, and then also what was the other
Eric Schneiderman stepping
down? No. But the point being,
that North Korea in general, Joe.
I think North Korea, but I'm just trying to think. There was another victory that he had. He's seeing the walking away of from the Iran deal as a positive as well. So that he was having a good week diplomatically, and so the question being. If there is success, I mean, success is success, though. If we bring stability to that part of the world, that's not a bad thing, right?
Well, wait a second now. If they're firing rockets at each other in Israel and Iran, it's hardly successful. I mean, this is the potential for another world war. Mm-hmm. We've always known that that's where it could happen, and this is really awful. So the idea of giving a guy a Nobel Prize, Peace Prize, for what he may or may not have done in Korea, let's assume he has, while the rockets are flying, and we know that at the point at which it gets really dangerous, the United States and Trump are going to be right there supporting Israel. So, and that could be a major thing.
Well, the foreign policy was front and center this week, and the threat to stability in the Middle East, certainly, you know, a fire was a match, so to speak, was certainly thrown into the powder keg there by the decision to remove ourselves from the Iran nuclear deal. I cannot see how you can claim a victory on foreign policy by basically saying to all of your allies in Europe, and Russia, to the extent that we were working together with Russia as well as China, I don't see how you can claim it as a victory for the United States to be walking away from a deal that had us actually slowing down the time with which this country, who was also experiencing some political tensions amongst the traditionalists and the younger, you know, population that wants to part way from tradition, which I think was behind a lot of President Obama's thinking in engaging in the Iran nuclear deal, is that by the time the sun begins to set on so many of these provisions, there's going to be some change within the country that will bring that country more into line with the rest of the Middle East and the rest of the world. And so the idea that we just, you know, push away from that, and now we're talking about sanctions. And on the other hand, we're elevating, you know, one of the world's greatest, you know, terrorists to a global stage by meeting with this guy because he's released, you know, hostages. By the way, you can only become a hostage
if you're taken,
right? And the fact that you now call him a nice guy and you're elevating him here, I don't know who he's appealing to in terms of this national and foreign policy strategy, because I don't even think his 30% really quite understand foreign policy, to be quite frank with you. But I think he's done more
Julie's
harm
than
well.
Uh-oh.
You're going to get a letter from
the base.
No,
the
Trump base doesn't
No,
understand.
I get it. But I do know that, you know, that we consider those 30% to be uninformed and basically politically illiterate. And yet they're voters and they make a huge difference. And David, I want to respond to one thing you just said that I think may be wrong. It's not that you're not right about everything you said just there. It's that he does it. I mean, that's what he does, and he gets away with it. He keeps saying, "I got a great victory," and while you say, "I don't see how he can say that," he sees it.
That's true. I mean, that's true. I guess, you know, here's the thing. I guess if you're a grown man and you're an adult and you're playing, you know, basketball against a 5-year-old and you dunk it over his head, you can claim that being a victory too. But no sane person, no rational person could see that as a victory.
Well, his polls are going up, number one. So far be it from me to argue for him. because on the one hand, we see what he's doing. We don't like it. You don't like it. I don't like it. We say, how can any sane person see it that way? But I will take you back in history to the great liars of history, the Stalins and the, you know, and the Maos and the other guys. They just said what they wanted to, and everybody else quaked in their boots.
I just want to point one thing out to you in regards to the poll. I don't disagree with the fact that his polling numbers are going up, nor do I disagree with the reasons why those polls are going up, right? Mm-hmm. I will take exception, however, to the fact that you're going to see those numbers start to decline again, because in addition to the trade war that he's just threatened China as well as other leaders, we now have new sanctions that he's about to drop on Iran, which directly impact on China, on Russia, as well as our partners in Europe. So I don't understand how, on the one hand, you can say, okay, we're going to create certain carve-outs for our allies in Europe when it comes to, you know, trade, but we're going to really slap you with sanctions when you decide to open a BMW plant, you know, in Iran, or have some parts made there. So I think when Americans start to feel it in their pocketbooks because of our consumption of goods from these countries, I think that's when you're going to start to see people make that connection between the policies that he's endorsing and enforcing and the consequences to those policies.
Well said, of course, but we are experiencing a huge growth in the American economy right now, right? And therefore, that may take a while.
Well, it's still the longest expansion right now, and that bottom is still going to come at some point. You know, this is not going to be a stable market for much, much longer. So at this point, you know, people are feeling good, but once that market starts to drop, you're going to see those poll numbers plummet immediately.
Back to the letters, we go to Carol, who says, "Hi, panel. Pruitt's expensive phone booth, perhaps it's a connection to call Russia? Maybe it's not too far-fetched. What do you think?"
I don't think it's for Pruitt to call Russia. I think Pruitt is just very paranoid, and he had a whole secure room right in his building. Why he needed the booth, I don't know. But
I could only surmise that he better be calling a lawyer.
Right. Yeah, maybe now. That booth comes in handy now. Right. But it's part of this whole pattern of his unbelievable arrogance and spending of federal tax dollars. I mean, you all are normal people, so you're probably not reading every single Pruitt article like I am. But his you know, luxury vacation trips to not only Italy and Morocco, but going to polluters conventions at luxury resorts and golf courses. It's just, you know, as someone who worked for the federal EPA and was so careful to not accept one cup of coffee, to see how Pruitt is fleecing federal taxpayers is extraordinary.
But I think, you know, when I hear people talk
about
Pruitt.
So you're bitter about the coffee, right?
What?
So you're bitter about the coffee,
very
right?
Very bitter about the
should
coffee.
Have taken bitter coffee.
Bitter coffee, right.
When I hear people criticize Pruitt, I'm always quick to remind them that, you know, if you're a person in Pruitt's position, you are taking all of your cues from the top.
Yes.
And if the top isn't demonstrating restraint, and those who surround the top are not demonstrating restraint, a la Mr. Cohen and AT&T, then I don't know how a person with the ego of a Scott Pruitt can demonstrate restraint. And to me, I think it's equally offensive when you decide to take a private plane to go to Fort Knox so that you can see the eclipse.
Right, right. I think Pruitt is out trumping Trump. And I urged reporters to look at his record when he was in Oklahoma. And when he was in Oklahoma, he purchased a home with lobbyists, with a shell company. When he was Oklahoma AG, suddenly he wanted an office closer to his personal residence. I think this is a lifelong problem with Scott Pruitt.
So this would have been when he was honing his skills.
Right.
Oklahoma.
Yes, he was practicing for a
pre-season
federal position.
But it's a psychological issue. You have to... You're quite right, Judith. I think you're exactly right. It is a profile of the guy. Freud, I'm sorry for this, said character doesn't change after you're 4 years old. And I think if you go back with Pruitt, you see the arrogance, you see the greed, you see all of that, and that hasn't changed.
Right.
Yeah, that leopard came with, spots intact to right. D.C.
And it probably part of the job description working for the Trump administration, right. as you say, David. You can kind of you get away with it because the tone is set from the top.
Yeah, if you can get away with it, if you carry the mail, right? In other words, they're willing to stick with Pruitt because he is so despicable when it comes to the environment, and that is their message. And as long as that's happening, and he's doing it, and they're happy with that, I think he stays.
I think if you're an administration that is so open to influence from special interest, yep. I don't know that his staying in place is a decision from the White House, or is that a decision that's being made by special interest? Yeah, like, well, hey,
and maybe they're one and the same.
Yeah,
they may be one and the same.
The fossil fuel companies and the sadly evangelical groups have really weighed in and pressured the White House to keep Pruitt. But if you really have legitimate investigations and you see violations of federal ethics laws and other federal law, it kind of doesn't matter as long as you have a responsible professional enforcer of those laws.
I think what we're also seeing, and I hate to say this, is the amount of money and resources that have been devoted to a campaign to besmirch Robert Mueller. And that's definitely had a lot of influence in the most recent polls in the shift of Republicans who no longer see Robert Mueller as a legitimate, non-political player in all of this. So I think their thinking is the same, no matter what charges are brought up against, this one person in the form of Mr. Pruitt. If the special interest enjoy this person and want him, they're going to spend the same amount of money and energy in trying to discredit the investigation.
All right, real quick, I've got two letters and we've got about a minute before we have to go take a break. So Bob in Albany writes this with the subject line separating families. Yesterday, NPR ran an interview with the HHS secretary in which he strongly defended the separation of families as completely appropriate because it's only being done with families who cross the border illegally, thus making the adults arrested criminals, not sanctuary seekers. Ms. Nielsen is not a heroine standing up to a bully. She's just another tool. Diana writes, in regards to a comment, backbreaking work for $5 an hour that Americans don't want to do. Had to pull over quick on my job and as a female American landscaper, and I love it. If more Americans did this work, they wouldn't be so out of touch with the environment. P.S. My illegal immigrant neighbor made up to $80 an hour at construction jobs and sent most money back to his country to invest in his apartment building. Money isn't everything, and more Americans could benefit from tending their own land and communities. I am so grateful to Weed Whack, even with a college education. And the crowd goes silent. Okay. All right.
Well, look, she's entitled to that point. Certainly she's not wrong.
No, she isn't. And she. I just wonder whether or not she leaves a little American flag on the lawn
right.
once the work has been done.
Yeah. The whole tiered around the whole lawn right there. Yeah.
I hope so. Diana, thank you very much. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we will continue our conversation. Alan Chartok, Judah Thank, David Soares, and Joe Bonilla making up the group today. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. 7 minutes past 10 o'clock on this Friday morning. Very nice to have you with us for the roundtable panel. Alan Chartok, Judah Thank, David Soares, Joe Bonilla. I'm Joe Donahue. We have letters. Let's go to those and talk about what is going on. Denise says, an Iran-Israel conflict is very unlikely to lead to a wider war. That would only happen if Russia were to become directly involved in defending Iran, which makes no sense on any level. Now, India versus Pakistan, both with nuclear arsenals, that's a whole other story.
Well, no. Basically, this will lead to a larger, more global conflict. I mean, we've seen this time and time again in history, so I don't agree with this right here.
And Denise, we do have Russia in Syria, actively mm-hmm. in Syria yes. right now. And I might also add that, the sanctions that are going to be imposed against Iran will collaterally impact on India as well, thus waking up a sleeping giant, in India, who also has nuclear capabilities. You know, this just goes to, I think, remind everyone how the importance of foreign policy, but also the importance of having a group of people, in your administration that engages in thoughtful discussion and weighs all of the collateral consequences before these decisions are made. And they're not just simply made either on Twitter or just made because, you don't like the last guy that was occupying this position.
Or influenced by John Bolton, who's never seen a war he didn't like.
But right. will not fight in.
Right.
Right.
Ben writes, I disagree with the comment made by a listener saying Donald Trump and 90% of the Republicans are the greatest threat to America. The greatest threat is the apathy demonstrated by the 50% of Americans that don't vote. How different this country would be if we had a better voter turnout in every election.
That's absolutely 1,000%
like
correct.
That
and, yeah.
Yeah.
Doug says, a sewer by any other name. I think we need to stop using the term drain the swamp. Wetlands and swamps are perhaps the most valuable property on the planet and critical to our survival. Yeah. If it talks like a sewer, smells like a sewer, hey, it's a sewer. Let's drain the sewer.
Did I write that?
I think you may have.
I love wetlands. I always didn't like drain the swamp.
So far, we have elitist Joe.
Yep.
And we have the foreign investment lawnmower and... And now we can't talk about swamps.
We can't talk about swamps.
Swamps is off the list.
Yeah, it's off the limits.
Bob asks, why do evangelicals especially like Pruitt?
Well, it's very bizarre. Pruitt, and I certainly respect his religious beliefs and others, but there's a tiny, tiny strain of his evangelical beliefs that says that we are here to dominate the earth, and if there are natural resources in the ground, i.e. oil and gas, we should be good stewards and use those natural resources. It just happens to line up with the agenda of ExxonMobil and Shell and Conoco. But evangelicals, I think, that's how he rationalized it. But I think evangelicals stand by the Trump administration simply because they're very interested in the judge appointments. They're willing to turn their heads on everything for judicial appointments.
That's out of Shell 316, by the way.
And Janice, real quick on Scott Pruitt, says, does Scott Pruitt not have a budget?
Oh, he has a huge budget, but there are also rules, like not flying first class and not using tax dollars for personal trips home to Oklahoma on the weekend. And your foreign travel is supposed to be related to your policy goals. For instance, my boss at EPA, Gina McCarthy, went to the Paris Climate Accord negotiation, and she went to UN meetings all over the world to advance a climate change agenda. Scott Pruitt went to Morocco to promote the export of liquefied natural gas by a company, only one company in a position to do it, and that's a lobbyist who he had a personal relationship with. So
Great. There's
a big budget, but you're supposed to use it to like clean up toxic waste sites and reduce air pollution.
And I believe the head of his security detail has also resigned.
He's resigned, yes. Many have resigned in Pruitt world.
Of course, the thing that I liked about the head of his security and the recommendations, if someone in coach yells at you, man, you get to first class real quick for security reasons.
Right.
So I'm just begging someone the next time I'm on a flight, just please yell at me. Scream, please.
Yes.
Well, my answer to that is people in first class have to up their game. Why aren't people in first class politely and respectfully saying, Mr. Pruitt, why are you, destroying the earth, sir?
Mr. Pruitt, there are seats in the back.
Right.
You know, Joe, changing the subject, we had a letter this morning from somebody asking why David Soros wasn't being appointed Attorney General of New York.
Oh, boy. Because he just loves...
I mean, after all, you've been covering Albany. It's in your group.
Loves Albany County.
That they're always scared.
Loves Albany County.
Yeah, and that's right.
That's the answer.
You know that this particular governor has a... this particular governor does not do what he's supposed to be doing when it comes to properly funding the DA's office. I'm going to say it because David never will. because David's office is the one that is supposed to be looking at all of this stuff, and he does what he can.
You're absolutely right. You know that
silence.
You know, no, it's not silence. You know, the reality is that, you know, if you have one, you know, constitution, you have one standard of law, and everyone, you know, we're a state and a country of laws, then people should be held accountable. You can't punish the guy who steals a Snicker bar at a Price Chopper and look the other way when you have someone who's misappropriating, you know, campaign contributions. And and you know, I think that it contributes to a level of cynicism on the part of the electorate when they continue to watch year after year as people who are of a certain standing or who have certain titles, you know, not be held accountable like them. And so, you know, the failure to actively pursue these and to support the prosecution of these kinds of cases further erodes confidence in our government. And that doesn't benefit anyone, whether you're a Democrat, Republican, Independent, Conservative, or Liberal.
So I do want to just slightly shift the subject when we're talking about Eric Schneiderman, because it was an article that came out in the New York Times yesterday, I believe, about the effect that he has on what this will have on the environmental initiatives in the state. He was the first attorney general to open an investigation into ExxonMobil's climate policies and statements. And will those continue without him?
I think so. You know, full disclosure, I worked in the attorney general's office for 8 years in the Environmental Protection Bureau a few AGs ago. And that bureau is amazing. They are the best public interest environmental law firm in the country. They just don't get paid what private law firms get paid. But they are the best environmental lawyers. Years ago, under Bob Abrams, he very wisely brought scientists into the Environmental Bureau and a couple policy advisors. And so they really know what they're doing. Eric Schneiderman had filed about 100 lawsuits or administrative actions against the Trump administration. So it was starting to feel like it was full. And announcing the investigations or the lawsuits are the easy thing. The hard thing is now bringing the cases. And so lucky for us, New York State taxpayers, there's a very good group there that'll keep it going. The acting Attorney General, Barbara Underwood, has said that she's going to continue with the cases that were filed. It's entirely possible you may not see a lot of new cases in the environmental space, but quite honestly, I think they kind of saturated the field already. You know, that's not to say that leadership at the top isn't really important. It is. Schneiderman aggressively challenged the Trump anti-environmental agenda, and I happen to think the best way to stop the Trump anti-environmental agenda is in the courts, along with public engagement and hitting members of Congress with concerns. But I think in terms of the actual work, it will continue.
So my question would be, and I hope that you'll take it as it's offered as a gentle, simple reminder, why won't the stinking, rotten political class at the top of the Albany agenda make sure that Barbara Underwood gets reappointed for the rest of this year, which she has now indicated she'd like to do? She's a terrific mind. And then probably, because, you know, I'm against ageism, probably appointed attorney general for the state, in which case she would win. But you watch what they'll do. They'll put some hack in there, and that is disgusting.
Well, Alan, let me just say that this is the second time in my career that I've witnessed the constitutional crisis that we're experiencing right now. The first being when my office had prosecuted Alan Hevesy, and the disposition required him stepping down. And the constitutional battle that took place between the governor and the legislature.
Yeah.
You know, they're trying to avoid that very public event right now, but there's a lot of discussions as to who will eventually occupy that position. Let me just say that Barbara Underwood is one of the most brilliant minds in the state of New York, and we are so fortunate to have her in that office. And I can also state emphatically that the Attorney General's office in the state of New York is one of the most amazing prosecutorial agencies in the country. And as a leader there, I think Mr. Schneiderman certainly prioritized the kinds of cases that they were going to make and bring, which is the obligation of the leader there. But as far as the work that goes on, the day-to-day investigations, that's still being done by the career people there.
And yet, David, the people at the top have to decide whether it is in their own personal political interest or the interest of the people of New York State when they make decisions. And that's why it's important, right? You know this as well as I do.
You have to be fearless in that position and do the work and believe that you have the support of the citizens. Now, I can tell you that that independence streak starts to erode when you are put in a position by the powers that be, because then the people who you eventually have to succumb to are the people in those positions of power. And so, we're all sort of holding our breath and waiting to see what comes next with this position.
Yeah, and I think some of these candidates for attorney general realize that getting the blessing of the state legislature may not, in fact, be an asset. So people like Preet Bharara and Zephyr Teachout, who have all said they might be interested, they haven't announced anything, they're not going to be interviewed next week by legislators.
Absolutely.
And, you know, there's kind of a timing issue. The conventions, the political conventions are 2 weeks out, then the November election. And Remember, the last time I believe the legislature appointed an attorney general was Assemblymember G. Oliver Coppell from the Bronx, the sponsor of the bottle bill. Thank you. He served for just a few months, ran in a Democratic primary, and lost. So it may not be the leg up that Tish James and Senator Gennaris and others think it may be.
Well, you're also forgetting the primary, too, so we have that coming up in September.
Exactly. Right. And here's the thing. If the convention doesn't lay hands on you and give you the 20% you need in order to run without getting signatures, then you got to go out and get signatures, which is an anathema to a lot of people. However, if you got to get those signatures, it is actually a good thing for you because it helps you mobilize support.
Talk to people, build a campaign volunteer base. I fully agree. It's a very short time period, and I wasn't sure what I thought about Barbara Underwood staying in versus others, because remember, with the Mueller investigation, there might be an important role for the New York Attorney General's office. And so you want someone clear-eyed in that situation. And I think, you know, sticking with someone as qualified as Barbara Underwood during these politically turbulent times may, in fact, be the best move here.
One of the most frustrating things about the Attorney General's office in particular is the view that it's always been a stepping stone into the governor's
AG stands for aspiring governor.
Aspiring governor, and that is frustrating.
Almost governor.
Yeah, almost governor. Yeah. That's always been frustrating to people like myself, because you know it is an office that represents the state of New York. New York is clearly a leader in so many ways and in so many issues, and it sets the bar for the rest of the nation. And when you have a federal government that is quite honestly under the leadership of someone who doesn't share the values of a state like New York, it's important to have a person in that position that's going to be, you know, interested in taking on those fights and not be part of the political apparatus of the state of New York.
Right. This feels like such a politically vulnerable and important time. But at the end of the day, I think Alan is right. The legislature won't be able to resist appointing, quote, one of their own. And they'll rationalize it and say, well, Barbara Underwood will stay on in the attorney general's office. We'll have the benefit of her steady hand, but let's cut a deal. And I think the most disturbing press account I read, and I have nothing at all against Tish James, the very capable New York City public advocate, but apparently there's some talk of if she gets the post, then the Bronx Democrats cut a deal for the county, borough president, Ruben Diaz, to become public advocate.
Those are the reverberations right now.
Yeah.
Right.
Like, that's not the way to make these decisions, but it is how Albany works.
Let us be very, very clear that this position requires someone who is going to be incredibly independent,
right,
tough-minded, and will carry on the desires of the constituents and not the desires of the political apparatus of the state of New York.
And that's why I think Preet, by the way, becomes a very attractive candidate in all of this. My problem is I think he's probably getting paid more by CNN than he'll ever make as attorney general.
And he's a wonderful prosecutor, a brilliant prosecutor, but also someone that others are willing to follow into the fire.
Yeah. You bet.
Right. We haven't talked about the governor in this conversation, though.
That's good.
but obviously he's going to have input.
He's got a candidate. He's got candidates. He would in a moment name somebody from his own political apparatus.
Well, he was trying to do that. He was advancing Alfonso David, his own counsel, and I think that went over like a lead balloon.
Of course, of course. That's right. He is he's a guy who never gives up. He always you can always sort of see the way the ball is going to get played. And the last thing he wants, remember, this is a governor who, when he moved from attorney general, had a fight with the new attorney general based on the fact that he wanted to take some of the prerogatives of the attorney general's office with him to the governorship. Right. It was unbelievable.
Yeah, right. But I think it's the culture of the state. I mean, when Alan Hevesy stepped down in the assembly and then Governor Spitzer were in at war as to who would replace him. I think Governor Spitzer spent a lot of political capital attacking, you know, Tom DiNapoli, who, you know, by every measure has done a fantastic job and continues
very
to do
good
a fantastic
point.
Job.
And the reason it's such a good point is that in that case, the Assembly did name one of their own, and it has turned out to be one of the best decisions anybody could have made.
Right.
That's correct.
In talking about New York figures, let us spend a moment to remind listeners that Rudolph Giuliani's law firm, they have severed ties with
a moment of silence, please.
A moment of silence. Then they went on the defensive. They asked for his resignation. He gave him his resignation. Again, they had the resignation letter ready.
Yeah.
and then went on to undercut his recent statements defending the president. And he had taken a leave of absence, and they said, oh, that's a good idea. Don't come back. And go ahead, Alan.
Well, but the killer statement here was the one that could get, and David Sorzo to come in on this one, could get him disbarred, which is we lawyers often make decisions without telling our clients.
That's just crazy. That's just crazy that he made. And you know, what is unique here is the fact that Rudy Giuliani was a prosecutor, right? I mean, so at his core is a prosecutor who became a politician and should know how to navigate, you know, the world of the court of law and you know, the court of public opinion. And to sit there and sound like a buffoon and say things like that when you know that those accounts, those IOLA accounts that are managed by law firms and managed by attorneys, are certainly looked upon, you know, with a fine tooth comb, to be able to just say, oh yeah, well, you know, there's a ton of money that's dumped in there, and you know, oftentimes these payments are made without the knowledge of the client. I mean, yeah, if you're a partner in a major law firm and you have a variety of clients because your practice is so wide in varying and you have a wonderful reputation, you can't have this man out there.
I think we should all just ask ourselves, God forbid if we were ever in legal difficulty, civil or criminal, would we want Rudy Giuliani as our own lawyer?
Well, it depends. It depends on whether or not his influence is as extensive as he claims it is. As for me, I know I'm going to get a few letters on this, but every time I see him, I see sort of this braying donkey.
let me shift. I would just say I don't want Rudy Giuliani representing me if I have a traffic ticket. I don't think he's a skilled lawyer who has the ability to represent his client in
as
a way that the client deserves. He's a self-promoter who
wants
to be back in the news.
He's a pyromaniac is what he is.
Carl
I mean,
Barker.
He is a pyromaniac. And quite honestly, he'll... You know, usually when people step down from a position, they say, I'm stepping down to spend more time with my family.
Right.
He said he's stepping down to spend more time with Donald Trump. So
and Fox News.
And Fox, yes.
Well, and
he, Fox
he
News.
Said in a statement that he missed being, for the last year and a half, he had been sidelined. He hadn't been on television. He missed being on TV. He missed, I think he said something about creating a stir. Well, he's done that.
So why do you become the president's lawyer? You should just get a show on Fox and you can talk all day.
But he's not the president's lawyer because the president has a team of attorneys. And certainly those attorneys cannot be too happy with this man out there advancing some of the theories that directly undercut their defenses for the president.
Only the best people.
The article in the New York Times points out that that the president is sort of going both ways on this, in the sense that he is complaining about Rudy Giuliani's gaffes and what he's saying, but he has also said that he's happy that he's getting the information out, and that he is a team player, and he's getting the word out that when it comes to this special counsel inquiry.
Well, last Friday he was saying he's, you know, was just on the job a day. He's the new kid. You know, the kid will figure it out.
And, they're distancing himself.
Once again, the politics of distraction. If Rudy's getting the negative publicity, Donald ain't.
Smoke and mirrors.
Yeah, but you know, the thing that I continue to remind folks to pay attention to here is the fact that, you know, you don't hear anything from the special prosecutor. You're not hearing any leaks. But believe you me that his team is actively investigating. And so what you have to think about at this moment is what has transpired in the last 3 weeks that would prompt, you know, Donald Trump to be so desperate to get Rudolph Giuliani on the air.
Right.
It's a signal that there is something going on, something that has happened, that's changed.
The Cohen raid, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Well, and
a little more than that, I think.
Yeah, and then all the
other stuff
the other
of what that.
And we never even got to the Cohen issue of all of these major corporations and others putting major money into Cohen's practice, as he brags that he has influence. And of course, if the other guy has, if he has influence, and the Mueller people can prove that the president acquiesced in that influence, then you really got something.
And that isn't little money. I mean, in the Washington Post article on this, Cohen had a $600,000 deal with AT&T. Specifying that he would advise on a Time Warner merger.
Because he's an expert on that.
Absolutely.
And an expert on Obamacare. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, he had Time Warner Cable, and AT&T was his carrier, and you put the two together, and you're an expert.
I went to the doctor. I just want to point out that in New York State, we all knew it for a long time. Whoever became the special assistant to Shelley Silver and others, and then went on to a lobbying practice, got a lot of business.
Right. Well, so the contract that he had with AT&T specified that he would provide advice on the $85 billion merger, which required the approval of federal antitrust regulators. Trump had voiced opposition to the merger during the presidential campaign, and his administration ultimately opposed the AT&T effort. The Justice Department filed suit in November to block the deal, and that case is pending. So were they getting what they paid for?
They may. I mean, look. If you're the head of AT&T, or if you're the people who are running AT&T, and that is the path to success, or the only thing that's left, you do it.
Well, the other distinction here to make is the fact that during the campaign trail, you know, given CNN being owned by Time Warner and now this possible merger, it was one of the companies and, you know, transactions that he heavily criticized, signaling to AT&T that they were going to have some problems there. I think if you're investigating your Mueller, what you're doing is you're also looking for other opportunities where the president may have signaled to a corporation that they were going to have problems, and to see if this man went out there and followed suit and tried to extort money from them.
Raising the question, will Cohen flip?
Well,
I think we all vote
every day
yes,
gets
right?
greater and greater. Absolutely.
I just want to leave you
that man of principle.
We are out of time, but I just want to leave you with my favorite line from the Washington Post article regarding the AT&T deal with Cohen. It is unclear what insight Cohen, a longtime real estate attorney and former taxicab operator, could have provided AT&T on complex telecom matters.
I love the taxicab. That's great.
Yeah. Nice little jab there.
Well, Luca Brasi was a... Wasn't Luca Brasi a consultant for...
You make a point. You make a point, David. Joe Bonilla, David Soares, Judith Enk, Alan Chartok, have a beautiful weekend. Thank you very much. Happy Mother's Day.
Thank you.
Have a beautiful Mother's Day. Everybody, we'll be back coming up right after this.